KAZU, Pacific Grove, California. This is broadcast number 555, and it's July 26, 1982. Before I begin the program, I will make the usual disclaimer. Everything said on this program is my responsibility, not the station's. I stand by the names that I mentioned and the activities going on and take total responsibility for these particular broadcasts of World Watcher. And that's a lot. Almost every week, I've been talking about the notorious Fritz Kramer for a particular reason. And I think just as you try to get a point across in advertising of repeating a name over and over, whenever it's pertinent, I'm going to bring up this name. There's a new book out about Alexander Haig. I just saw it a few minutes ago in the bookstore. Section on page 101, 102, and 103. I couldn't afford to buy it this week, but I'll get it on the man, the German, the Kraut, who was behind the career of Alexander Haig and also the man behind the career of Henry Kissinger. And every day these men get more and more important. They're not going to fade away. And if you don't like what they've done for the last 20 years, then smoke out Fritz Kramer and help me do that. Now, I consulted several people who are active with activities over in Israel and with the intelligence community in the United States and have written letters trying to find out about the Fritz Kramer, who was Adolf Hitler's chief of staff, and the Fritz Kramer, who was working in our Pentagon, who recruited Henry Kissinger to be with the German generals and chief of staffs after the war before he began his career, Henry Kissinger at Harvard. And this book on Haig tells how this Fritz Kramer catapulted the career of Henry Kissinger at Harvard. One of the addresses I got was to Jerusalem, to the Holocaust Center there, where they keep a record of every war criminal and where they went after the war. So the institution is called the Yad Vashem, and I wrote to Jerusalem on June the 5th, 1982, and got a letter back this week in response to the request that I made about Fritz Kramer. What I asked them over there was, where did the Nazi war criminal Fritz Kramer go after the end of World War II? That's after May the 8th, 1945, when he was taken away and was last seen in July of 1946 as a war criminal at the trial of Dachau and was supposed to serve 10 years in jail, but was released with the help of Americans in Atlanta, Georgia, and at Georgetown University and the military. I got a one-sentence response to my letter, and this is the organization that keeps track of the missing Nazis, or they're supposed to keep track of where they go. They wrote to me, in reply to your letter to Dr. Y. Arad of May 6, 1982, we hereby inform you that we do not have any information concerning the fate of the criminal Fritz Kramer after the World War II. Sincerely, S. Kalavach, from the archives in Jerusalem. Now, here is a man who was active with Adolf Hitler in the SS in the early days. He was one of his most trusted persons, a person high up in the intelligence of Adolf Hitler, who was recognized in various books for his importance, not very many, but a few that I've seen. And I asked them where he went after World War II. Now, I have copies and photographs from books of him as a war criminal. I've mentioned those before, but they say they have no record of him after the war. And this is a very dangerous response because he becomes a non-person, and the Fritz Kramer running our State Department and the Pentagon is also invisible or not seen or photographed. And I will continue to pursue it on the belief that they are one and the same person, that this country was sold out in 1943, and I call the project Kramer versus Kramer. If any of you saw the movie this last week, it was on public broadcasting, a wonderful program called Whitewash of a Murder, Roses in December, the story of Jean Donovan, one of the four women that were murdered down El Salvador last year, December 2nd, 1980, 2 years ago. And it showed the bloody executions down there and the terror down El Salvador. And the man representing the State Department as Secretary of State defending those actions was Alexander Haig. It's easy to relate to a single murder on the screen. It's easier than to think of 20,000 killed in Lebanon Sometimes the vast numbers are difficult to comprehend, but no matter how you add it or slice it or divide it, the common denominator in all of these events just happens to be Mr. Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger, and Alexander Haig. And if you don't like these things, help me smoke them out in whatever way we can. Playboy has an interview with, it's about Alexander Haig. It's titled, the article is Campaign of Cunning, the Inside Story of Alexander Haig's Rise to Power by Roger Morris. And this is just one section of that book that just came out about Haig. And even in Playboy, if you don't have the book yet, it tells about the catapulting to power of Alexander Haig through the help of this German with the monocle, the person who manipulated him, who put him into position. And this article in Playboy goes into the German occupation and how Henry Kissinger was over there with Fritz Kramer and how Alexander Haig's career just leaped. And as soon as Richard Nixon was nominated to be president of the United States and hired Alexander Haig, hired Henry Kissinger, he brought in Alexander Haig as assistant of the National Security Council. And this Playboy excerpt from the book tells about the telephone call that they got in December 1968 to bring this obscure colonel magically into the inner sanctum, the protege of Fritz Kramer, with the help of Joe Califano. He brought in this Alexander Haig and Henry Kissinger into the Nixon administration to continue the assassination teams that were operating and are in the news today, and I'll get into that later with the Italian and London scandals. This assassination team took over when Richard Nixon was president. Already John and Robert Kennedy were killed, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and maybe 200 or 300 others. But this story in the book and also the excerpt in Playboy tells about the Fritz Kramer, the monocled person, the large head, the German education and accent. The 60-year-old Kramer displayed Gothic affections and political preferences that made him more than Kissinger, a Strangelovian figure. He had risen from a precocious army private in World War II intelligence to a Pentagon backroom advisor and then the chief strategist of the army. Now, he didn't rise Army intelligence in the United States Army. He had a doctor's degree from Germany and one from Italy, and he came over and became part of German intelligence to take Kissinger into the army and then place him at Harvard. So there is this book out about Alexander Haig, and there is the article in the Playboy. Now, the meeting of the Bohemian Grove this last week in California with the heads of states took on an interesting, you can look at it as comical, but it isn't very funny, the interesting turn. George Shultz was there, Caspar Weinberger was there, Alexander Haig was there, Henry Kissinger was there. Kissinger gave the main speech at the Bohemian Grove, and it was a very violent anti-Russian speech, the kind that the Kramer would appreciate, Mr. Kramer, from the IG Farben family. His family are from the chemical dyes in Germany. And when Kissinger got up to speak, they played Hail to the Chief. Now, the chief flew home because he didn't attend Bohemian Grove this year. The chief went to Washington, and I would give you five or six reasons why I think this chief doesn't have too much longer to go. But they played Hail to the Chief, and Henry got up and said, "No, no, I'm just Henry Kissinger." And all of these people at Bohemian Grove treated him with the utmost respect, and they are grooming him maybe for the first non-American-born future president of the United States, the protege of Fritz Kramer. And if you don't like him, you better find out again who Fritz Kramer is. There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle magazine section in May 1981 about the Bay of Pigs operation and a captain of the Bay of Pigs named Ernito Oliva, O-L-I-V-A, who was the command head of the Brigade 2506. And when the Bay of Pigs operation was called off, Oliva, who's funded by the CIA, went to work in the Pentagon. He was designated to belong to Alexander Haig's department in the Pentagon. He, after the Bay of Pigs failure, and we know now all the CIA Bay of Pigs people that were involved in the murder of John Kennedy, he was assigned to the office of the Secretary of the Army and worked under Joseph Califano and Califano's young deputy at the time, after the Bay of Pigs, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander M. Haig, who is now our Secretary of State, when this came out last year. Oliva was suddenly out of business because Kennedy was dead. I'm reading this to you from the San Francisco Chronicle. He was out of business because Kennedy was dead. At Robert Kennedy's request, LBJ gave Oliva the word about the end of the special aid for the Cubans. Robert Kennedy, after 1963, when John Kennedy was killed, said, "We're not going to give special aid to the Cubans." Oliva worked for Alexander Haig until Kennedy was murdered, then stayed in the Army, went with the paratroopers in Santo Domingo, worked in the District of Columbia for the government there in the Human Resources Coordination Department. He was acting chief of that department's Developmental Disability Division. He now lives in Washington, D.C. He's the father of a pre-med student at Georgetown University, and he lives in Maryland. This is one of the chief brigades of the brigades of the anti-Castro Cubans that were involved in the murder of John Kennedy, who was assigned to Alexander Haig's office after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, or the horrendous events that took place there. And when Kennedy was dead, he moved on to other departments. But he worked under Alexander Haig at that time. There are other pieces of evidence on Haig and the CIA and the assassination teams that I'll go into later, but I did want to mention that I did get the letter from Jerusalem, and they've never heard of the Nazi Fritz Kramer. They've never heard of that man since World War II. So let's look out. Now, going back to the British-Italian scandals that are taking place now, because I've been talking about those for the last few weeks, and they are so large and horrendous that there are very few articles that don't begin by just mentioning how broad the investigation is going to be, and it will continue. This investigation I'm referring to has to do with the banking scandals in Italy, the links to the London banks, the links to the British royal family, to the German banks, to the treasurer of the Vatican, Paul Marcinkus, to the dummy fronts down in Panama. He has dummy front operations, and in Peru and Argentina, and the flow of capital, billions of dollars flown out of Europe that will create a crisis and a cause and effect action. Now, one of the things that I mentioned is set off or triggered Israel to be able to go into Lebanon at the time they did, and I mentioned it before, was the shooting of the Israeli diplomat, Mr. Argov, in London. Now, shooting this person, gunning him down, wasn't the most important factor. The fact was that when they found the four persons who contributed to the gunning down, then Israel was home free to do what they wanted, because the list of people would link the operations of the CIA to the so-called leftist terrorist groups, and the hit list was probably so horrendous because these people have already been linked to the murder of Mountbatten and Neri Neve in London or in Ireland, and the heads of states of many countries, even in the United States, whether it was J. Edgar Hoover, William Sullivan of the FBI, or William Harvey of the FBI, the chief investigators in this country, Sheffield Edwards, any person who is the middleman between the operators and the top echelon often has to be murdered when these scandals break. There's large pockets of murders at the time of Watergate, at the time of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and these murders, the shifting of jobs, and the closing up of banks is going to follow these Italian scandals, and goodness knows how long it will go on. But when that shooting took place in London, the hit list that they located mentioned a group called Black June, which is a splinter group, just as the men who bombed the troops in London, the British troops that were changing the guard, is a splinter group, an unknown, relative, obscure group. The list, the men involved with this were Jordanian, Iraqi, Syrian with links to Arafat, but not the PLO. That's important because the network of what we have always called the terror network, the left network, the killings, the people that were to be killed, were high up people, just as witnesses say to the Vatican financial scandal, judges, investigators, high up officials in Italy, have to be killed. And the point is that when that list was obtained, that gave Israel the chance to do anything they wanted to cling out Lebanon. And every country is sitting back and watching it and absolutely can't move. Now, I link that to bringing home Edwin Wilson, who's worked for the CIA and Defense Department, who was brought home at the time all these activities were taking place. And last week, Wilson wanted his bail reduced to $20 million. And they turned him down. He came home with $18 million that he picked up in Zurich that I've mentioned before. But I want to repeat some of this because it's important. Now, they turned down the reduction of bail because he had a plot to kill the principal prosecutor, the attorney in his case, Lawrence Barsella Jr. And the way he was going to do it was, according to the Los Angeles Times, Ronald Ostrow, was that he was going to set up a law office, and one of the ways, and hire this government employer, this prosecutor, when he was older or retired. And then he would set him up with a large amount of money in a private law firm, and then they would kill him in the law office. Now, I can't tell you how many suspicious deaths of lawyers or U.S. attorneys, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges that are working on critical cases that die right in the middle of these jobs. And people think, well, you're too paranoid, you're looking for too much in these cases. But every person who dies isn't part of a conspiracy. But many people that are directly linked to a conspiracy drop dead right in the middle of the action. So this one of the ways Wilson was going to kill him, or will kill him, he had planned to set up these law offices later for him, and he said he'll kill him even if he's 70, he'll get him someday. But one of the other things he said, they had hired Frank Turpel, who had hired PLO assassins to murder Barsella and the family. So you read in the headline, the PLO did this, the PLO did that, the PLO gunned down this businessman, this rabbi, this judge, this banker. Everything can be blamed on the Red Brigades and the PLO. But the point is that when the lists are obtained, when the banks are opened up, when the investigations are laid on the table, it goes back to mainly the United States government, the intelligence community, because this is where the funds are coming from, and a larger international group, but the CIA takes the blunt of the responsibility. Wilson and Turpel are CIA Navy intelligence agents, so they were going to hire PLO to do their job. Some people are just killed, and they don't bother to blame the PLO, but this is the whipping boy of these various intelligence agencies, and they give them the go-ahead, and if the PLO is shot on the spot, they say, oh, too bad, we caught him escaping. But Wilson and Turpel, who are very magnanimous American CIA people, hire other people to do the murder for them and, if necessary, go to the expense of setting up law offices. Now, along the lines of the scandals, there's several things going on in England that are very important. The full coverage isn't carried here, and I want to mention briefly what's going on. We really won't know. Maybe we won't know the full story. But simultaneously with the Buckingham Palace Gate, London is calling it the Buckingham Palace Gate, there's a large spy scandal. Now, Italy has had their large spy scandal, which broke open in 1981. And it wasn't the left. It was the far-right Nazi plan to coup, take over the government, just like the links of the right wing and the CIA and the Bush family to the Hinckleys to take over and shoot Ronald Reagan just before the Pope was shot, or the Nazi connections of the Pope and the far right in Spain and the attempt to take three islands, the Falklands, the Seychelles, and the Dominica, that would be headquarters for Nazi organizations throughout the world. All of this has been attempted since 1981 and stopped. So one article in the London Times this last week said ministers face barrage over spy scandal. We've heard about the spy scandal for a week, But they haven't told us what it was, and there's one sentence that describes it. Amid growing allegations of security lapse, and senior ministers moved last night to curb speculation that they face an espionage scandal of the gravity of Philby Burgess McLean affair. Now, that was a horrendous long scandal that I can go into with you later. But in this case, they had a British intelligence that set up the American CIA and worked with the Americans and British intelligence. Kim Philby and the others fled to the Soviet Union and were Russian spies. But in the case of Great Britain, I think it goes the other way, and there's a fascist element that wants to take over the country and have even more control than they have at the present time, certainly more than they have at the present time. Now, the San Francisco Examiner had one story. There's speculation about the attempted cover-up of the entire incident. This is in the Queen's Visitor. It says it's called Buckingham Palace Gate. A London newspaper, the London Daily Express, was tipped to the story 3 days after it happened. Nobody knew. The result could become the biggest government scandal in years. Well, on the one hand, we have the biggest spy story in ages, and we have the biggest scandal in years. Now, just briefly, and I don't want to dwell too long on it, there was one article in the Associated Press this week, Palace Prowler, the Plot Thickens. And briefly, there were 10 or 12 things wrong with the story of the visitor with the Queen. In the first place, the police ignored the alarm when the fellow was in the room with the stamp collection. He ignored it. It went off. He ignored it. Secondly, this Fagan was seen scaling a wall by an off-duty cop, and when he called the police, the off-duty cop, they told him the equivalent of shut up, a brisk response, get away. Third, the palace clinger, somebody who was clinging, saw him walking down the hall and didn't challenge who it was. Not that he had a mop or rag or what he was doing. And then there was discrepancy of whether it was 3 in the morning, 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning, 7:15. He was seen in the halls. Nobody challenged him. Fourth, the Queen's bedroom is guarded, but the guard went off walking the dogs and nobody was there. How would he know which room it was? You're in a place with several hundred rooms. I don't know. If there's no one at the door guarding it and you just conveniently have the doggies out, how would you know which room? Another point, the Standard newspaper in London said the monarch used the phone and called the police, but they didn't think it was serious and they didn't come. Another account, it wasn't the phone call, but a maid came in for 10 minutes, and then she and the Queen were with Fagan for another 8 minutes before the police came in, which is 18 minutes. Another account, the panic button failed and didn't go off at all, versus the account that she heard it and they didn't respond. The London Telegraph said the police heard the bell, but they ignored it. The other one was that they didn't take it seriously. In the third account, they didn't hear it at all. Then how he evaded, got into the room, there's a question in the various newspapers. He evaded sensory devices and cameras. They have them on the wall, the outside, and he scaled the walls that are covered with barbed wire and spikes, and there was no sign that he actually came in that way. He was seen in the halls, but there's no way. Somebody saw him on a wall, but he couldn't get over one of these points. The other story is he pulled a screen and went through the screen and entered that way, versus he was walking down the hall, and there were two versions. Maybe he tried to get up, went to the stamp room, but he was able to find his way exactly to the place he wanted without finding the wrong door once. The policeman on duty at the end of the corridor left 30 minutes early. He usually leaves at 6 o'clock. He left 30 minutes early at this time. Another point is that this fellow evaded 43 soldiers, 24 police officers, 350 palace staff members, dog patrols, surveillance cameras, electronic devices, and got right to the Queen's bed and had a chat with her. First accounts were 3 in the morning, as I say, then it was 6, then it was 7, then it was 7:15, and finally, no criminal charges will be pressed. The London Times, the July 18th issue, said that they had a history on this Fagan the last month when he was arrested for allegedly stabbing his stepson with a screwdriver in the neck, but it was unreported. There was no report of the arrest. Scotland Yard never approached any social workers, although he's been closely watched since the 1950s. Now, one report said he's been watched since the 50s. If he's 30 years old, has he been watched since he's 5 years old? They've had him under some kind of surveillance for a long time, but certainly that couldn't be wrong. And, of course, his family said, his wife and his mother said that he had been there many times, and they wouldn't have any reason to say that. And finally, the Queen went to from Windsor Castle afterwards, but she had to stop at the hospital. She stayed at the King Edward VII Hospital for Officers. It's the first time in her life she ever was in a hospital, and she went there the next day and stayed there. It was for a wisdom tooth, but everything else that she's ever had, she was taken care of at her own dwelling and not at the hospital. And she was in the hospital for the first time in her life. The official report was he scaled the wall at 6:45. He climbed through a window. He wandered unchallenged through the castle. He made his way to the private apartments. He entered at 7:15, which is totally wrong with every other time. She called the switchboard at 7:18. She called again at 7:24. They talked to him in the pantry, and then he was escorted out. Now, my own view of this thing and the discrepancies and how many times he was there and his background of surveillance and not being charged with these other offenses, they weren't in the records. The only thing he was charged with was taking a half a bottle of wine once before when he was in the castle. There is a lot more going on, and the banks of the Queen of England and the royal family are involved with Roberto Calvi. And Roberto Calvi was murdered in London, and he went there, and who he saw at the interim that he was there before he was murdered has as much to do with why this Fagan was talking to the Queen, because, as I said, there's tremendous investments of millions of dollars involved in this scandal in the British banks, in the German banks, in the international banks. We haven't yet felt the full repercussions of this. So this meeting that seemed a little bizarre was strange in so many ways, and we will not hear the end of it yet, but they are calling it in England the Castle Gate. It's like their Watergate, and they know there's a big story there. How much will come out, or whether it will be linked to the spy story in a year or two or very soon, we don't know. Now, Roberto Calvi, according to the London Times, that's the Italian who was murdered in London, traveled with 11 bodyguards. He was nervous because one of the fellows that he worked with was shot in the legs, and he said that when he was wounded, he said that Roberto Rossoni was shot in the legs, the next thing they want is me. They're going to kill me. So wherever he went, he had 11 bodyguards. When they shoot Rossoni, they're really shooting at me. And he mentioned that he didn't want to be murdered in London. And, of course, the newspaper this last week said that the decision was there was a suicide. Odd death of Italian banker ruled suicide. The British press, the LA Times, and various news media knew that the decision would be suicide, but the articles already were saying that this was a cover-up. So then you have to ask the question, why is it so necessary to cover up Roberto Calvi? Because what he was doing in London and what he had with him that he took out of the Swiss banks and who he saw before he was murdered and the relationship of the British royal family to the banks that he dealt with and invested in and who funded Michael Sindona and Paul Marcinkus and tangled the British royal family banks into the Vatican, whoever knows the interconnecting webs of this story has to declare him a suicide. To say he's murdered makes the story more horrendous. We'll take a one-minute break now and go back into the major articles on these subjects that are in the news this week so that you can follow them if you want to. Otherwise, I'll briefly describe them to you because there's so much coming out at this time.